Tonight, we're wanting to look at the Great Siege of Malta of 1565. This is one of the most incredible heroic struggles and stories ever. One of the most amazing times of fortitude under the most relentless attack imaginable. In 1565, Islam was threatening all of Europe. The Ottoman Turkish Empire conquered the entire Middle East. They had sacked the greatest city in the world at that time, Constantinople, which has since been renamed Istanbul. They massacred the Christian population of Istanbul. In 1526, the Turks had unsuccessfully besieged Vienna in the very heart of Europe. Muslim slave raiders were depopulating whole villages, attacking coastal towns of Italy, France, Spain, Portugal, England, Wales, and Ireland. They even seized white slaves as far away as Iceland. Ultimately, over 1.1 million Christian Europeans were kidnapped and were enslaved by Muslim pirates between 1500 and 1800. One thorn in the side of the aggressive expansionism of the Ottoman Empire was the Christian island of Malta. Malta was the headquarters of the last crusaders, the Knights Hospitaller, also known as the Order of St. John of Jerusalem. The Knights of St. John had proved to be the most tenacious enemies of Islamic Jihad. They were the last knights to leave the Holy Land. And from the island of Rhodes, they had raided Islamic shipping, setting many Christian captives free from Islamic slavery. And after enduring severe sieges on the island of Rhodes, their position in the eastern Mediterranean had become indefensible. They had to sail away, leaving that island to the Muslims after 6 incredible months siege because there was no way they could continue to operate there. They were isolated. And the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Charles V, offered the Knights of St. John the island of Malta as a new base for the operations. Not a very nice place. There's no rivers. It's just an island of sandstone and limestone. It's a rough rock with very, very little soil on it. It's a rock in the ocean, but it was a strategic spot. They had to pay, by the way, 1 falcon a year to the viceroy of Sicily in order to have this island. Well, on the 26th of October 1530, the knights sailed into Malta's Grand Harbour, and soon they turned the strategic island into a naval base from which they intercepted many Muslim slave raiders and endangered the lucrative Muslim piracy and slavery racket. Throughout the years, the Guerre de Corps, the running war, the battle between the Muslim slave-raiding pirates and the Knights of St. John continued unabated. For centuries, the Knights of St. John were the only forces stopping the Muslim pirates from raiding the coasts of Europe. As the Knights of St. John continued to interdict and harass the Turkish piracy routes, Suleiman the Magnificent, here are his titles that this humble man gives, Vice-Regent of God on Earth, Lord of the Lords of the East and the West, Possessor of Men's Necks, King of Believers and Unbelievers, Majestic Caesar, and on it went on, getting worse and worse. Yes. He mobilized the largest armada ever seen, even bigger than the Spanish armada that attacked England later on in the same century. He mobilized 193 ships with 40,000 fighting men, including over 6,300 of the Janissaries, the elite. They were the invincible ones. The Janissaries were the best soldiers the Sultan ever had. All of them came from Christian families. It was part of the blood levy, where the Muslims would come and demand 1 out of every 5 sons born to Christians, and they would choose which one. They'd choose the biggest, the strongest, the healthiest, the fittest. And they would raise them from young, maybe from age 6, 7, 8, and they would never know love, they'd never know any affection, they'd just be trained to be fanatical jihadists, and they were the expendables, and they were the most brutal and the most tenacious of all the Muslim fighters. Their objective was to wipe out the Knights of St. John from the face of the earth and to capture the strategic island of Malta for Islam, because it was preventing the expansion into the western part of the Mediterranean. And so long as Malta remains in the hands of the Knights, so long will relief from Constantinople to Tripoli run the danger of being taken or destroyed. That cursed rock, the Sultan said, is like a barrier interposed between us and your possessions. Remember, your possessions are everything that you can steal from the Christians. Now, this wasn't the first time that the Turks had attempted to seize Malta. There was an earlier siege. In 1551, the corsair, or the pirate, Tagore, had invaded the island with a force of over 10,000 fighting men. You would have thought that would have been enough, but it wasn't. This attempt failed, and Tagore withdrew, and so he bombarded the neighboring island of Gozo in frustration. And after the population surrendered and opened their gates, the Muslims looted the town and enslaved virtually the entire population of 5,000 people. So they depopulated Gozo in one go. That was their consolation prize for failing to get the main island of Malta. Now, as a result of this failed siege of 1551, the Knights of St. John strengthened Fort St. Angelo at the tip of Burgu. Here's Fort St. Angelo. That's where the headquarters was. And then they built two new forts. There's Fort St. Michael at the landward side of Sanglier. And then they built a new fort at the end of Mount Skibberas, which is Fort St. Elmo, which plays such a key role. These three forts were absolutely vital in the defense of Malta. The Grand Master of the Order of St. John, Jean de Valais, began vigorous preparations to enable Malta to survive an extended siege. And in May 1560, a disaster occurred. The Ottoman navy had a victorious battle at the Battle of Jerba. Jerba was a total disaster for the Spanish. The Spanish sent a huge naval expedition to the coasts of what today is Libya, to the coast of Tripoli, in order to evict the corsair pirates there, who of course raiding Spanish possessions in Naples and Sicily, France, Spain. And so they came to try and deal with the pirates, and they were surprised, and they were outnumbered, and they were wiped out, and most of the naval expedition were sunk. And this disaster marked the highest point of Ottoman-Turkish domination of the Mediterranean Sea, and that's just before the siege. So, as Delavette's espionage network informed him of the imminent invasion, he set about accumulating stores, ammunition, strengthening fortifications, recruiting further fighting men, and recalling all knights, wherever they were, to Malta. And he did such a good job that while the Turks ran short of water, and the Turks ran short of ammunition, and the Turks ran short of food, the defense of Malta never ran short during the whole siege. That's how well he prepared for the siege. The official historian of the order, Giacomo Bosio, recorded that the Turkish fleet consists of 193 vessels, including 131 galleys, 7 galliots, 11 large merchant ships. One of these merchant ships had 600 armed men, 6,000 barrels of gunpowder, and 1,300 rounds of cannonball. So you can imagine how big these ships were. Balbi de Corrigio, in his famous siege diary, records that the Turkish invading force consisted of 6,300 janissaries, over 6,000 spies or cavalry, 4,000 religious fanatics, that's what they were called, 2,500 spies from Romania, 500 spies from Karamania, and 6,000 other volunteers, and then various corsairs or pirates from Tripoli, Algeria. It totaled over 48,000 fighting men in all, not counting the attendant slaves and others who would be coming along just helping them in a practical way, but the fighting men were 48,000. On the Christian side, there were less than 700 Knights of St. John. There were 400 Spanish soldiers, 800 Italian soldiers, 200 Greek and Sicilian soldiers, approximately 3,000 soldiers drawn from the Maltese population who had no military experience at all. And there were other civilians who were given weapons, a total force of less than 9,000 men. But of them, you're only talking about 2,000 who had any kind of proper military training and experience. The Grand Master of the Order of St. John, Jean de la Valette, was 71 years old. He had been a Knight of St. John since he was 18 years old. He had been a veteran of the Siege of Rhodes in 1522. De la Valette had survived a year as a galley slave when he was captured by the Turks, and he had to row up to 20 hours a day in a Muslim galley. Later they had a prison exchange, so this man had a tough training. The letter challenged his knights. It is a great battle of the cross and the Quran which is now to be fought. A formidable army of infidels are at the point of invading our island. We, for our part, are the chosen soldiers of the cross. And if heaven requires the sacrifice of our lives, there can be no better occasion than this. Let us hasten then, my brothers, to the sacred altar. There we will renew our vows and retain by our faith in the sacred sacraments that contempt for death which alone can render us invincible. When the knights left the church, they were filled with enthusiastic joy. It was reported that after the service, every kind of weakness disappeared, all divisions between them and all private animosities ceased. They realized they were entering the fight of their life. The knights of the Order of St. John of Jerusalem were devout. They were aristocratic, they were warlike. They boasted the bluest of blood amongst the members that came from the noblest of families. The military monks had developed an efficient security service providing armed escorts for Christian pilgrims travelling through the dangerous Holy Land. And after the success of the First Crusade, when it captured Jerusalem, they became a military order in 1113. So they were military monks, they were religious soldiers. Young aristocrats from Spain, Portugal, England, France, Germany, Italy enthusiastically joined the Knights of St. John. The Knights became recognized as the very front line of the battle for Christendom. They were a bulwark to keep Europe safe from Islamic jihadists. The Knights of St. John were respected as the toughest soldiers in Christendom, just as the jihadists recognized the Janissaries as their tougher soldiers. So now you've got 6,300 Janissaries against 700 knights. In 1522, 7,000 knights and soldiers on the island of Rhodes had resisted over 90,000 of the Sultan's forces for 6 months. Only when all their supplies were exhausted, when no possibility of continuing the fight remained, did the Knights of St. John board their ships and withdraw in good order, leaving the island to the Muslims. As the sun rose on the 18th of May, 1565, the horizon of Malta filled with sails emblazoned with the Sultan's red crescent. The great siege of Malta had begun. The invaders were supremely confident that they would be able to overwhelm and subjugate the small band of knights on this island of Malta. You can see how it works here. You've got in the center here on Mount Scarabus, you've got Fort St. Angelo. Over here across the bay of the Grand Harbor, you have got here Fort St. Angelo. On this side, we have got Fort St. Michael. These are the three key places that the fight is going to take place over. The Muslims, of course, had to bring their ships onto the far side to not be under the fire of Fort St. Angelo and Fort St. Michael. Here you can see a better view of it, how the first part of the battle is going to be against Fort St. Elmo. They would put on this point artillery, they would put on the other side gallows point artillery, they would put artillery on this side of the bay to bombard Fort St. Angelo, they put artillery on this side to bombard Fort St. Michael, all along the landward side they were attacking also, and then on the seaward side they would be bombarding as well. So they put the artillery on all sides. Their first target was the Fort St. Angelo, which dominated the entrance to the Grand Harbour. A mere 100 knights and 500 soldiers held Fort St. Elmo, and they would face the full might of the Sultan's army. Della Valletta had ordered them to fight to the last man. He said the length of their survival would determine the outcome of the whole campaign. They had to bleed the Muslims. They had to devastate them. They had to make them pay such a high price for that little fort that they would not have the strength to continue the campaign. So as long as they could hold out, the better for the campaign. And also they were hoping for relief, of course, from Europe. The Turks had estimated that they would need just 3 days to bombard St. Elmo into submission. Yet the garrison of St. Elmo held on through an incredible 35 days of constant bombardment and waves of assault. All of Europe was praying fervently, realizing what was at stake. As Queen Elizabeth of England declared, if the Turks should prevail against the island of Malta, it is uncertain what peril might follow to the rest of Christendom. They recognized this was a matter of all of Europe was at stake. Mustafa Pasha ordered the huge siege guns to be dragged onto Mount Scarabus. two 60-pound culverins. So they shot 60-pound shot, 60-pound, almost 30 kilograms. There were 10 80-pounders, so their shell would be 80 pounds. And then there was an enormous basilisk, which fired a solid 160-pound shot. That's 80-odd kilograms per shell. And these were brought for the attack on St. Elmo. And a week of preparation and bombardment by such heavy artillery, the sandstone and the lime blocks comprising the fort of St. Elmo had begun to crumble. The Turks relentlessly pounded away at the small fort. After the first night of bombardment, the besieged knights made a sortie, the last thing that the Turks expected. They stealthily lowered their drawbridge, captured the closest enemy trench, stormed out and wiped out a vast amount of the enemy who were sleeping in the trenches. Mustafa commanded Janissaries forward, and as the Janissaries stormed the trenches, they were cut down by the cannon at St. Elmo. They were trying to provoke just such a response, just showing the spirit of defense of the knights. The arrival of Djadjut, known amongst his men as the Drawn Sword of Islam, as the scourge of the Christians, this encouraged the Turkish forces. He brought another 1,500 of his elite warriors. And Djadjut noticed what Mustafa had missed. The strength of St. Elmo was the resupplies they received each night from St. Angelo. Across the bay, they rode across more resupplies, more reinforcements every night. As the artillery bombardment of St. Elmo doubled in intensity, the defenders tried to erect counter walls behind the crumbling walls. At this time, word reached Della Valletta that the relief hoped for from nearby Sicily had been seriously delayed. This was a crippling piece of news. Valletta read the dispatch to his council and declared, "We now know that we cannot look to others for our deliverance. It is only upon God and our own swords that we must rely." Yet this is no reason to be disheartened. Rather, the opposite. For it is better to know the truth of one's situation than to be deceived by false hopes. Our faith and the honor of our order are in our own hands. We shall not fail. On the 3rd of June, a new battery was erected on Tigny Point, and this opened up a further steady fire in St. Elmo. Then the Janissaries attacked. They swarmed over the reduced Ravelin. The Ravelin, if you've seen the front of the castle of Cape Town, there's this outer wall. That's a Ravelin. This pointed outer wall, they call a Ravelin. That's to try and take the first blows of artillery and the first waves of enemy attacks, break them up, and when they come over there, then they're in a killing zone from the main towers and the main bastions. So, as they storm towards the gates of St. Elmo, the cannon protecting the portcullis, obviously you've got to, that's the metal grid that protects the main gate. The cannon protecting portcullis opened fire on advancing ranks of Janissaries and tore huge holes in them. The defenders of St. Elmo used burning hoops that they threw over the Muslims so it would set their white robes ablaze. And arquebus shots and blocks of stone were thrown upon the attackers, and the Muslims were set alight with cauldrons of boiling pitch poured over the walls, and many of the invaders were set aflame. From dawn until noon, the battle raged around the bridge and the walls of St. Elmo. Yet the flag of the Knights of St. John still waved above the ramparts, which were engulfed in flames and smoke. You've no doubt heard of the fires of St. Elmo, or St. Elmo's fire. That is it. It burned day and night for 35 days. Wave after wave of Janissaries were unleashed upon St. Elmo, and by the time Mustafa called off his troops, over 2,000 of the Janissaries lay dead, as opposed to 10 knights and 70 soldiers who had died defending St. Elmo that day. That's one third of the Janissaries had been wiped out in the initial attack on St. Elmo, something they could never have anticipated. And by the way, the guns at St. Angelo were using the fires at night to be able to target the enemy and give supporting fire to St. Elmo's across the bay. Here's a report that still exists. You can see this in the museum in Malta. A report sent from St. Elmo that very night said, "Pounded by hostile cannon, in arms always, prepared for combat by day, exposed to the burning sun, and by night to the cold and the damp. Privation of all kinds, from the blast of gunpowder, smoke, dust, wildfire, iron and stones, musketry, explosions of enormous batteries, insufficient nutrient, so disfigured that we hardly know each other anymore. ashamed of retiring for wounds, not manifestly quite dangerous or almost mortal. Those with the smaller bones dislocated or shattered, and livid faces bruised with frightful sores, or extremely lame and limping woefully, those miserably bandaged around the head, arms in slings, strange contortions, such figures were frequent and nearly general. The Turkish gunfire was so heavy it seemed that they were determined to reduce the fortress to powder. On Thursday, another Turkish attack was blasted by a hail of bullets and incendiary weapons. Yet the defenders came under such sustained fire that they could barely show themselves above the battlements. When the commander suggested that the fortress be evacuated and burned to the ground because they couldn't defend it anymore, Valletta reminded them, "We swore obedience when we joined the order. We swore also on the vows of chivalry that our lives would be sacrificed for the faith whenever and wherever the call ought to come. Our brethren in St. Elmo must now accept that sacrifice." The knights sent a further message urging, "Do not send any further reinforcements, since there will be no more than dead men." They requested permission to storm the enemy and die honorably in battle, rather than remaining pounded behind the walls. Imagine just the noise and the attack. It's after a while you get this kind of cannon fatigue where your senses are just unable to take anymore. They just want to go out and charge the enemy and die quickly. And Valletta responded, "The laws of honor cannot necessarily be satisfied by throwing away one's life when it seems convenient. A soldier's duty is to obey. You will tell your comrades that they are to stay at their post, they are to remain there, they are not to sally forth." La Valletta sent another 15 knights and almost 100 soldiers to strengthen the garrison at St. Elmo. And the Ottomans stormed the fort repeatedly and were repulsed time and again. The first great night attack of the siege took place on 10th of June. They'd been under attack since 18th of May. 10th of June. When dawn broke, over 1,500 of the Sultan's troops lay dead or dying in no man's land between the ravelin and the fort. St. Elmo's losses that night totaled 60. The Turkish commander-in-chief now offered the Christians that they might retire unmolested. Mustafa promised them, "You can go with your weapons, you leave the fort to us, we'll let you go in peace." Each one resolved to die where they stood and to give no quarter. There was to be no surrender, no retreat. On the night of the 15th of June, the whole Turkish fleet ringed the fort and 4,000 guns opened up on St. Elmo. Then the Layalas, the fanatical corps of jihadists on drugs, launched a frenzied attack. They were followed by a horde of dervishes and then the Janissaries. Each attack was decimated and sent fleeing by the ferocious defense of the Knights of St. Elmo. Another 1,000 Turks died that day and 150 of the garrison of St. Elmo. On the 18th of June, La Valletta called for more volunteers to reinforce St. Elmo. Now, no, these people who rowed across, they knew there's no chance of survival. They were rowing across to bleed the enemy and, of course, to give their own lives. 30 knights and another 300 soldiers came forward and volunteered, and they rowed across the harbour to the beleaguered and bombarded garrison at St. Elmo. On the same day, Jajut, the most famous of the Arab soldiers, was wounded by cannon shot. And as the drawn sword of Islam was carried back to his tent, morale amongst the invading Turks was seriously weakened, and he died shortly thereafter. As St. Elmo was pummeled by concentrated bombardment, it seemed incredible that anything could exist in that smouldering ruin. As the Janissaries breached the walls, the Cavalier de Montserrat directed cannon against the center of the Janissary attack and saved the day. That day, St. Elmo lost 200 men, and the Turks lost over 2,000. At dawn of the 23rd of June, the Ottoman galleys surrounded the ruined fort and unleashed more death and destruction upon the valiant defenders of St. Elmo. At this point, there was less than 100 remaining. They sang hymns that could be heard across the bay. They defiantly tolled their chapel bell. They prepared to meet the Lord Jesus. Those who could no longer stand were seated in chairs, fully armed. Incredibly, they held out another hour. As Mustafa Pasha carried the banner of the Sultan Suleiman to replace the flag of St. John on the ruins of St. Elmo's, he gazed at the massive Fort St. Angelo across the bay, and he cried out, "Allah, if so small a son has cost us so dear, what price will we have to pay for for such a large father. 35 days of ferocious courage of the defenders of St. Elmo had cost the invaders precious time and over 9,000 of their best troops. Now, during this time, Europe had all the time to send reinforcements, but they still hadn't arrived. Mustafa Pasha ordered the bodies of the knights to be decapitated and the heads to be placed on stakes and the corpses nailed on crosses to be floated across the harbour. And so the next morning, as the headless bodies of crucified knights washed up at the base of Fort San Angelo, La Valletta ordered the Turkish prisoners to be executed, the heads to be used as cannonballs to bombard the Turks. And the message was clear. The knights should fight to the very death. No quarter would be given, none would be received. You treat our knights like this, this is how we're going to treat your people, and nobody can expect any quarter from either side. The morale of the defenders of Malta was lifted when four galleys from Sicily managed to evade the Turkish blockade and landed a small relief force of 42 knights and 700 militia. That was the resupply from Europe. But it was Wow. It was something. It was an encouragement, small as it was. Siege guns were now transported to the heights of Carradino to begin the bombardment of Fort San Angelo and Fort San Michael and the villages of Burgu and Sengeli, which they defended. 70 cannon from Mount Skibarus and from Gallows Point and from Tigny Point and from Mount Salvator from the heights of Carradino, they all opened up. A heavy crossfire on St. Angelo and St. Michael and on the villages of Burgu and St. Glier. Here you can see how the battle is continuing. Here's Gallows Point. Here's Mount Skarabas. From this point you can see the landward bombings from these heights, so they're now giving them a complete crossfire. On the morning of the 15th of July, Mustafa ordered the first major sea assault by both land and sea, coordinated. The Algerian troops stormed the walls of St. Michael from the landward side, while the Turks landed more troops to storm the seaward walls. And the Algerians came on with a wild screaming rush, and the Christians counterattacked and turned the tide of battle. They actually came out of the walls and they charged the enemy who were charging them. As the Muslim invaders fled, Mustafa sent in his masterstroke. He had 1,000 of his elite janissaries board 10 large boats to land at the northern wall while the Christian defenders were preoccupied defending the southern wall. What Mustafa did not know was that Valletti had positioned a battery of 5 artillery at the base of San Angelo to counter just such an eventuality. Cavalier de Guerrero, who commanded the 5-gun battery, could scarcely believe his eyes as he saw the janissary sailing straight towards the muzzles of his guns. At the ideal target range, he ordered his men to open fire, and 9 of the 10 boats were sunk, and 800 janissaries disappeared into the water. Only the 10th boat managed to survive and flee back across the harbour. The few janissaries who managed to make it to land received St. Elmo's pay. That's what they started to call it. When you gave no mercy to the Arabs, it was, we're giving them St. Elmo's pay. In other words, the wage of sin is death. The knights opened the gates and charged the Muslims and sent them fleeing. That was the 15th of July. Following the humiliation of 15th July, Mustafa adopted a more cautious approach. He depended upon his artillery to reduce the walls and undermine the morale of the defenders by incessant bombardment. From north and south, from east and west, the Christian fortresses came under withering and sustained artillery barrage. The Turks gave the besieged no respite. The bombardment continued all day, all night, throughout the last week of July. Finally, at the dawn of the 2nd of August, the Turks advanced with all their cannon thundering at once. People in Sicily, over 100 kilometers away, could hear the cannon fire. It was the heaviest bombardment of the siege, and it seemed impossible that any man could live through such sustained fire, let alone be in any state to fight in the crumbling ruins of the fort. When people get that kind of cannon fatigue, you can imagine that they might not even be able to, they're shell-shocked. Could they even fight? From every ridge and slope, the Muslims swarmed forward like a tidal wave against the garrisons. Yet attack after attack was repulsed, and Mustafa was once again forced to concede defeat and call for retreat. As his exhausted and decimated assault troops withdrew, Mustafa decided to subject the Christians to another 5 days of continuous bombardment before attempting the next assault. And these are the size of the cannonballs that were being thrown at them. These are the kind of scimitars that the Arabs were using. In all, over 130,000 cannonballs were fired from the Turkish guns against the Christian defenders of Malta. 130,000. Throughout the siege, men, women, children walked alongside the soldiers to repair the walls, to repair the defences, and to prepare bombs and ammunition, and particularly to prepare the incendiary devices with which to set the jalabas, the flowing robes of the Arabs, alight. On the 7th of August, the Islamic assault was renewed. Like a tsunami, the enemy rushed upon Birgu and Senglia simultaneously. Yet as they swept over the ditches half filled with rubble from the walls, through the breaches of the walls blasted by continuous cannon fire, they were confronted by another interior wall. The troops who had poured through the outer breaches now came under a withering fire from the garrison. They were unable to turn back because of the weight of the numbers pressed behind them. They were trapped in a narrow killing ground where they were slaughtered in their hundreds. Then the Christian defenders leapt from their entrenchments and they stormed the faltering attackers. The Muslims turned and fled, slipping and sliding over the blood of their comrades, tripping over the mounds of dead bodies, and they fled from the fight. Yet, while a Turkish attack on St. Angelo was routed, the assault on St. Michael was succeeding, and Turkish flags began to appear on all the ramparts. It was at this point that the governor of Medina, the capital of Malta, which was in the inland, launched his cavalry force against the lightly guarded Turkish headquarters. He estimated, he didn't have many men, but he estimated that the Arabs had left nothing in reserve. They put everything into the attack, and so they had. And the Christians overwhelmed the sentries at the command's headquarters of the Turks, killing every man that they could find, capturing or destroying a huge provision of stores and of their ammunition. As a messenger galloped up to Mustafa to inform him that a large Christian force had swarmed over the camp, Mustafa feared the worst. There could be no other force on the island. He wasn't even thinking of Medina because it's such a small town. He was convinced this must be the relief force from Sicily. So Mustafa ordered a general retreat. And this way, Fort St. Michael was saved. The Arabs had breached Fort St. Michael, but now they withdrew to try and regain their own camp, which was swarmed over by the Christians. But there was no relief force. It was merely the small garrison of Medina who had made this very timely strategic attack. Valletta called his council together that night and he informed the men. I will tell you now, openly, my brethren, there is no hope to be looked for except in the succor of Almighty God, the only true help. He who has looked after us until now will not forsake us, nor will he deliver us into the hands of the enemies of the holy faith. We are soldiers. We will die fighting. If by any evil chance the enemy should prevail, we can expect no better treatment than our brethren who were in St. Elmo. Let no man think that there can be any question of receiving honorable treatment or escaping with his life. If we are beaten, we shall all be killed. It would be better to die in battle than terribly and ignominiously in the hands of the Muslims. There was to be no more talk about relief forces. With the greatest devotion, with the firmest hope and the faith that they would be received into glory, the resolve to die for their cause. The Muslims now began to tunnel under the defences to plant mines, which was very hard because there wasn't much soil. Tunnelling in rock is next to impossible, but they tried. And with a tremendous explosion, the bastion of Castile in Senglia collapsed. And as the survivors staggered back in confusion, waves of Turks swarmed through the breach. Valletta seized the pike and ran forward from his command post towards the breach. And when they saw the Grand Master running towards the point of greatest danger, all the knights and the soldiers joined him in turning back the tide of the Islamic advance. A grenade exploded near Valletta, and the knights rushed to defend him. "Withdraw, sire, to a place of safety." Valletta refused. He recognized that his presence was making the difference there. He said, "The enemy is already in retreat." But Valletta still refused. Valletta continued to advance against the enemy, saying, "As long as their banners still wave in the wind, I will not withdraw." And the knights and the soldiers surged forward with incredible tenacity, and within a few minutes, the Turks were routed, fleeing in disarray. There was no darkness that night, as the gunfire lit up the sky and the cannon pounded the walls. Yet the Christians stood firm, and by dawn, the Turks had to withdraw in defeat. Now Mustafa unleashed his siege tower, which was higher than the walls, The Janissaries used its platform to fire upon the defenders of Burgu on the walls. But Valletta had his workmen burrow a hole in the base of the wall facing the tower. And they wheeled out a large cannon which fired two large cannonballs which were fastened together by a chain. And so this chain shot sliced through the structure, causing it to collapse, spilling Turks, their incendiary grenades and all their fuel, which set the giant tower ablaze. On the 20th of August, the Turks brought up another larger siege engine, reinforced at the base with earth and stonework so it couldn't be cannoned out as the last one was. But the Knights of St. John stormed the tower in a surprise sortie. No Muslims expected them to come outside the walls at this point. But they swept up the laddered floors, they eliminate the Janissaries in a matter of minutes. And they then turned the siege engine into an additional fighting platform to defend their walls. And the two Turkish cannon poured fire into the dismayed Muslims. At this point, Mustafa learned that a large supply ship from North Africa, which was coming to resupply the dwindling supplies of ammunition and food, had been captured by a Christian galley. So now despondency swept the Turkish camp. They were now running short of gunpowder that they had to suspend the bombardment. Thousands of Turks were laid low with sickness. Even water and food was in short supply for the attackers. Mustafa determined that he had to capture the capital, Medina, and use it for their winter quarters. Now, anticipating the Turkish intentions, the governor of Medina dressed the civilians in soldiers' uniforms and had them patrol the ramparts along with the garrison. All available cannon were brought to the side from which the Turkish assault would approach. They knew which side they were on, they came kind of this side. So as the Muslims toiled up the long slopes to the city, they were shocked to see the walls bristling with cannon and with armed men. As they came within range, the cannons immediately opened fire. The dismayed Turks halted and turned back. "It is another impregnable position. It is another St. Elmo," they said. The Turks launched another attack on St. Angelo and St. Michael on the 1st of September. But their men were by now so drained and disheartened, so reduced in numbers, so enfeebled by fever and by dysentery that the attack failed almost before it had begun. And the general consensus was, "It is not the will of Allah that we shall become masters of Malta." On 5 September, the Viceroy Don Garcia at last set sail from Sicily with a relief force made up of professional soldiers from all over Europe, including many Italians, Germans, French, other European volunteers. The relief consisted of 10,000 fighting men in 28 ships. When news of the relief arrived, 8 September, Mustafa's army was on the verge of mutiny. The Turkish fleet had lost the will to fight and they didn't even make an attempt to contest the landing. As invaders began to embark, Mustafa learned that the relief force was actually smaller than his own army, so he ordered his men back ashore. The relief force charged the Muslims and in a fierce battle slaughtered 3,000 of Mustafa's army, driving the remainder to the sea. Valletta rushed his cannon up to St. Elmo and fired upon the retreating fleet. And the day the Muslims fled Malta was the 11th of September. The bells and the churches rang out over the shattered houses of Burgu, and the victors sang Te Deum to the glory of God. Praise God from whom all blessings flow, to the God who grants victories. Nearly 250 knights of the Order of St. John had lost their lives in the great siege. The survivors were all wounded, many were crippled for life. Of the original 9,000 garrison, there were barely 600 still capable of fighting. The Turks had lost over 30,000 men in this four-month ordeal. 120-day siege. The Sultan Suleiman was devastated when he heard of this defeat. "Next year, I, myself, the Sultan Suleiman, I will lead an expedition against the accursed island. I will not spare one single inhabitant." But the following year, before he could carry out his threat, Suleiman died at age 72. At the beginning of his reign, he had been defeated before the walls of Vienna, 1529. Now at the end of his reign, his army had suffered the most humiliating and decisive defeat at Malta. The Ottoman Turks would never attempt to besiege Malta again. The failure of the siege denied Turkish forces control of Western Mediterranean and prevented their plans to conquer Southern Europe. The Great Siege of Malta was one of the most decisive victories in military history, changing the course of history and preventing the Western expansion of Turkish power. I've looked at quite a few books which speak of the greatest battles in history, and it's amazing how many omit this battle when it was so decisive. I saw one recently which had the 7 tipping points that saved Western civilization, and it didn't mention this, and I thought, this person does not understand his history if he can ignore battles like Lepanto and Vienna and Malta. All of Europe rejoiced in celebrating the victory, and in Malta the church bells rang out triumphantly. Honours were showered upon the Grand Master La Valette by all the kingdoms of Europe, which, let it be said, had not helped him in time, but maybe out of a sense of guilt, certainly out of gratitude and admiration. At last the Knights of St. John received the generous financial contributions that they needed to rebuild the ruined cities and fortresses of Malta and their fleets, and to be able to continue the work of defending Europe from Islam. The Italian engineer Francisco Zapparelli helped plan a magnificent citadel to be called Valletta, named after the hero of the siege of Malta. And Valletta is built on Mount Skibaris, including the site of Fort St. Elmo. Here's the new expanded Fort St. Elmo on the site where this huge battle took place. And this is the central part of now the island of Malta. The Cathedral of St. John in Valletta was described by Sir Walter Scott as the most impressive church in all of Europe. That's quite a statement to make. When he died, La Valletta was buried in a great crypt in the Cathedral of St. John, where the inscription reads, "Here lies La Valletta, the scourge of Africa and Asia, the shield of Europe, whence he expelled the barbarians by his holy arms." The heroic defense of Malta against such overwhelming odds for over 4 months of relentless bombardment and assault inspired all of Europe to renewed efforts to defeat the Turkish menace, which up till then they thought was unstoppable. And it led to many more victories over Islam. In 1571, the Turkish fleet was decisively annihilated at the Battle of Lepanto off the coast of Greece near Corinth. And then the last great Turkish threat to the heart of Europe was defeated at the gates of Vienna, 11th of September, 1683. Now, notice how the 11th of September is a very significant date. It was on this date that Vienna was saved. It's on this date that Malta was saved. Could the Muslims have chosen that date for a symbolic reason? I think they're very aware of history, and they're very aware of symbolism. But I haven't heard one American draw the comparison as to why 11 September was chosen for the attacks on America. If they knew their history and they knew what happened at Malta, and if they knew what happened in Vienna, then maybe they would have been able to understand. They're not just fighting against a few fanatics, they're fighting against an entire worldview, a clash of civilizations. Islam itself is the threat. And until they realize it, they're not going to win. This is a picture showing you here. You can see the River Danube and Vienna and the defenses. You can see the ravelins around Vienna, the churches in the center. Here's another picture of Vienna under attack at that stage. Notice how always the churches are right at the center. And here is a map of the military actions in the great battle at Vienna, which was defeated on 11 September 1683. And one of the key things about it was that the bakers heard tunneling under the walls, because their bakery was close to the walls, and Turkish engineers were burrowing under the walls. And they alerted the Viennese army, who burst in and surprised the engineers. And at that very time, the Polish relief coming with the great Cossacks came sweeping down, and they had these feathers on their helmets which whirred in the wind as they came down. There's this terrible sound of whirring winds as they came sweeping onto the Muslims. And they were beaten from both sides as the Viennese came out and attacked, and as the Poles came down and attacked from the other side. And this was the last threat to the heart of Europe militarily by the Muslims. Malta was one of the first nations in Europe to embrace Christianity after the Apostle Paul's shipwreck on the island. Malta has the highest church attendance of any country in Europe, with more than half of its total population attending church any given Sunday. Its area is a mere 316 kilometers square, consisting of 3 small islands with dry limestone hills and no rivers. The total population is just over 400,000. Malta received its independence from Britain in 1964, has been a parliamentary republic since 1974. Malta entered the European Union in 2004, and Malta celebrates 8th of September's national holiday to mark when the siege was lifted when the relief column arrived. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She will not be moved. God will help her just at the break of dawn. The nations raged. The kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice. The earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. So this is the town of Valletta, centered around St. Elmo, where the heroic struggle took place. Here you can see the new St. Elmo, and on this side, part of St. Angelo. And this is the fort of St. Angelo, where the Muslim Janissaries tried to assault, foolishly, by sea. And even today you can see what magnificent defences, obviously all rebuilt since that time in preparation for any further assault. The walls, phenomenal, with these double walls to make sure anyone who breaks through the outside only comes into a killing zone. This is the bell tower memorial for the siege of Malta. And you can see here in Medina, everything's well built to withstand sieges. The Red Tower. And this is part of St. Elmo. Very much the flag of the Knights of St. John. The entrance to Fort St. Elmo. Memorial to the knights who died on St. Elmo. The Order of St. John, now also known as the Order of Malta. Order of the Knights of Malta. These are the swords of the Order of St. John. These are the scimitars of the enemy that they captured, and some of the cannonballs. Some of the armor that the men wore, can you imagine wearing this in the heat of summer? The crossbows, these crossbows could go through armor. These were the prepared powder and shot, which the knights carried with them for quick reloading. They had the gunpowder and paper, and had the balls there that they could put in their arquebuses and reload quickly. This is something that was an innovation of the Knights of St. John. They had compressed air to propel a bullet. They used a compressed air rifle, which worked fairly well. These are enemy armor, scimitars, and guns captured from the Turks who attacked Malta. This is at the museum there in Malta. One of the statues in memory of the people who died at the battles in the siege of Malta. And of course there have been many different memorial stamps. This is now Malta put out a stamp in memory of 7th of October 1571, when the Turkish fleet was annihilated at the Battle of Lepanto.
You annihilated them?
That was a combined fleet which consisted of, it was led by the Austrian Don Juan. It had a lot of Spanish, a lot of German, a lot of Austrian, Italian composition. It was a huge fleet of almost 200 Christian ships going against 231 Muslim ships, and the Muslim ships were bigger. But it was a total defeat for the Arabs. The Arabs lost just about everything, the entire fleet. I think they came away with 15 ships that hadn't been captured or sunk. They lost 216 of their ships in that battle. Just one of the most decisive naval victories in history. We will look at Lepanto sometime. These are stamps that Malta brings out in memory of the attack of the Arabs. Here's the Arab ships, here's the Knights of St. John's emblem, and in memory of Della Valletta. And of course you have living memorials too. These are some of the people who will be there to guide tourists and show them around, wearing the uniforms of the time, and the Order of St. John for pageants. These are some of the books. This is the classic. This is the siege diary of one of the soldiers who took part in it, Francisco Balbi de Corregio. That's the classic. This is the Great Siege, Knights versus Turks, see MDLXV, that's 1565, by Stephen Spiteri. The Great Siege by Ernell Bradford has been brought out in a few different forms, first by Penguin and now by Wordsworth. It's of course now past any kind of limitation on copyright. This is The Great Siege of Malta by Neil Bradford. Clash of Cultures. Christian knights defend Western civilization against the Muslim tide. That's a title you don't get in too many books published today. The Siege of Malta, 1565. Malta, the Last Battle of the Crusades by Tim Pickles. And it's been republished in another format, Last Battle of the Crusades, with a lot of visuals. Angels in Iron is more of a novel, which gives the story from the perspective of a couple of people involved. The Knights of St. John of Jerusalem is another book that looks at the whole story. The Sword and the Scimitar by David Ball is another one of these historical fictions which focus on all around the truth of the fight with the battle around Malta. There have been other battles, Malta 1565, the Great Siege of Malta. But while these books exist, you won't get them in the average exclusive books. You've got to order them. There's some historical fiction like The Birth of the Kingdom, which is dealing with talking about the kingdom is another word that they use for the Knights of St. John. The Religion is another critical historical fiction of it. They lived for it, they fought for it, they died for it. Iron Fire, a novel of the Knights of Malta and the Last Battle of the Crusades. And this is the thing, anyone who says the Crusades ended in 1291 is missing all the fights on the Island of Rhodes and Malta and the ongoing battles of the Knights of St. John. They were Crusaders and they were fighting the Muslims, and for them the Crusades hadn't ended until somewhere in the 1600s when finally Vienna was liberated and the Muslims started to be chased out. Blood Rock is another more recent historical fiction work on this. The Great Siege, Clash of Empires. A brutal combat, a test of courage, a battle that will change history. Now, considering all that's been written on this, why is it that this battle is not so well known, not so well referred to? Pirates of Christ is a strange title. Of course, the Knights of St. John were not pirates, they were anti-pirates. They were there to interdict the Muslim pirates. The Muslims called them pirates. But to continue the war against Islam today, we don't have the Knights of St. John or the Knights Templar today, but we do have some good books because the pen is mightier than the sword. Islamic Invasion, War Against Radical Islam, Islam and Terrorism by Mark Gabriel, our book on slavery, terrorism, Islam. These are some of the weapons we can use to expose and oppose and fight Islam, with the Muslim Evangelism Workshop materials, with the Terrorism and Persecution, Understanding Islamic Jihad DVD, and explain what's going on in the Middle East, and also bringing what the Bible prophesies of the end of Islam. As a positive weapon that we can use to win Muslims to Christ, More Than Dreams is the best. It is a 5-testimony DVD in multi-languages that can be lent to or given to Muslims. It can be copied without cost and given out as widely as possible. There's no copyright, and we distribute many too. And Muslims can watch this in secret, and it's very effective. Muslims seeing testimonies of a Muslim in Nigeria coming to Christ, a Hausa, and a Swahili Muslim coming to Christ, and a Palestinian and an Egyptian. It's really powerful, Pakistani and so on. Now, we've got a lot of these materials on our web that can be used for exposing and opposing Islam and fighting the guilt manipulation that Muslims try to use against us. They're always trying to portray themselves as the victims and us as the villains, even after they've done terrible terrorism attacks against us. And the victory over the Muslims in Sudan, you could consider the fight in Sudan as another crusade. This is to a real extent. Nehemiah 4:14 says, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your daughters, your wives, and your homes. The desert tribes will bow before Christ, and his enemies will lick the dust. All kings will bow down to him, and all nations will serve him." We're involved in a battle, but there's no doubt whatsoever about the consequences and the victory. This is the target. This is the birthplace of the Christian church. It must be one for Christ.